Hi, I'm Bex.
And I'm Laura.
And we're here to talk openly and honestly about miscarriage, stillbirth, and all pregnancy loss.
We aim to smash the taboo surrounding these subjects.
And rebuild the topic in a way to support and educate women.
Rather than isolate and shame them.
Welcome
to the worst girl gang
ever.
Go on, Bex, you can do this one.
I'll do this one.
Okay.
Yeah. Welcome to this week's episode of The Worst Girl Gang Ever. We are so lucky to be joined by Amy and Ryan Jackson. Those of you who follow us closely will know that we were on a podcast episode recently of a different podcast called Still Parents Podcast. And Ryan was one of our lovely hosts. So thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for asking us to be part of yours.
That's all right.
Well, we've been on the other side, isn't it?
It is. It's quite nice, actually, tonight.
Yeah.
I've been messing around with gadgets and being.
Yeah, well, oh, I was going to say.
You and your gadgets.
We felt like absolute dickheads when after your podcast recording, because we obviously it was live, wasn't it?
It was.
And you had a studio and all this like wizardry.
Testing. Hang on. Should we do some testing, Bex?
Testing. It was a lot of this.
Testing.
I'm not going to drop the C-bomb, though. We got that in the
Amazing. So anyway, Amy, you haven't been able to get a word in edgeways. It's lovely to have you here too. Oh, is it? Yeah. Standard.
I know the feeling. I know how it feels.
So tell us a bit about yourselves. How did you come, first of all, to be a part of the worst girl gang ever?
I think we've obviously been a registered charity for just coming up to 10 years now. And we're continuously kind of signposting a lot of our clients and families that we support to other places that they can get support from kind of when we're not there. Mm. And the Worst Girl Gang was just one that had kind of popped up on my Instagram feed. And I liked a lot of your posts and just liked what you're doing. And you kind of fit in nicely with what we do as well. Mm. I just have been signposting a lot of our families onto you, really.
And sorry, your charity, I should have mentioned, is the Lily May Foundation.
Yeah.
And how did that start?
So we lost our daughter Lily in 2010 to stillbirth. And we just found kind of back then there was absolutely nothing out there locally for us. There was a few kind of small pockets of stuff, but it was really hard to access it. And kind of what we did access didn't really fit us as a couple kind of thing. So we slowly, a couple of years later, decided that we would start to do our own thing. And the charity's kind of built up over the years from there, really.
I mean, it's so needed because There was nothing really out there at that time, was there?
No, there was a...
It was like the olden days of the baby loss community.
It was back in the old... I'm very old. There was a national charity and we did access them for some support and we did meet some really good kind of close friends that were kind of going through it at the same time. And that's where we discovered that's what helped us kind of just chatting to other people who were going through it. Who could just really resonate with what we were kind of feeling and thinking. But that was literally kind of about it, really, in terms of support. Yeah.
Yeah, there was not much on social media at that time.
No, nothing.
And when you say about people who could like relate to what you were going through, that's really, really hard. And we've spoken lots about how it's really only people who have been through it who can truly understand. It's only really those people who can provide you with the comfort and reassurance and validation that you need. And it's often people on the internet who know your innermost thoughts more than those people around you, like your close family and friends. The internet has been, and social media has been amazing for providing this kind of support. So, I mean, you guys were probably like one of the first people to start up back then.
We're
in our 20s then.
So there really wasn't, and it was kind of I don't think Instagram was even
I think
it was kind of like before
Facebook had only been around for Well, I think Facebook really kicked off, didn't it, in about 2006, 2007. And I think people were still getting sort of used to being able to use social media as a tool.
Yeah, we were all on still on MySpace with Tom.
Yeah, MySpace, or something like that, I think the thing which we sort of, probably another reason why we started the charity was because, yes, we had support from SANS, and we went to a local SANS group. But it was very
structured.
It was very structured and set in their way. And I think for us, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been put in the situation, but we've got like one of those nervous laps where if you get put somewhere, if you get put somewhere where everything's so serious, but you're not. For me, it just didn't suit us.
I'm not surprised it didn't suit you if you were rocking up to baby loss groups and laughing. I mean, you must have been the most unwelcome attendee.
It's that silence time where people assume that that it's like a one size fits all.
Yeah.
And it's not a one size fits
all
because, you know, you have to, and I suppose coming from a teaching background, both of us as well, is that, you know, everybody's different and you have to differentiate your support, you know, channels, your support programs, everything like that, because, like I say, not one size does fit all. And I think what was really apparent back then was that it was very much a one size fits all approach that then didn't suit everybody's needs.
Yeah. We talk about that a lot, that one size fits all approach, because we said before, like, even if two people have an identical experience, it's still going to be completely different because of their upbringing, their education, the way they view life, you know, their ideas, aspirations, their career, everything like that thrown into the mix will make the experiences completely different.
Yeah.
And it is, I think personally, I think that one size fits all approach that is so damaging and so dangerous, because we all assume that it's going to, you know, even people within the baby loss community assume that their experience is going to be the same as someone else's experience. And when it's not, it needs to make the support look different for every individual.
Yeah. And then people start questioning themselves about comparing to other people. Why am I not?
We get a lot of families that are like that. Oh, so and so was doing this at this point. Why aren't I feeling like that? Why can't I do this now? And it's kind of like, oh, no, you need to completely erase that and just focus on yourself.
Yeah. What does the Lily Mo Foundation do? What do you say you set up after?
So we set up, and initially we just set up providing memory boxes. So we'd had a memory box from hospital, but it was very simple. It didn't really fit us as a family. So we spent a lot of time in between, because we found out Lily's heart had stopped on a Friday, and then I was sent home and brought back in on the Sunday to be induced. So that weekend, we kind of spent it kind of thinking about, oh, what do we want? What do we want to get? We want to get two teddies, we want to get this. And so, and it was horrible. It was like sending my mom to Mothercare to buy an outfit for her was just horrendous. So there's a lot of things that we thought, actually, do you know what? If they were in this box as well, then it would make it a lot easier for people in the long run. So to begin with, we just started doing that as a bit of a distraction as well, really, just something to do, because we were both off work, and supplying them to our local hospitals. And then again, it kind of grew from there, with the support in terms of kind of what we were then accessing. It was kind of like, oh, this support is offered, but actually we could do this a bit differently. We're not taking it away from that support, because some people might really gain from that support, but we want to offer something different. So we did the support meetings to begin with.
Even if it was something down to, you know, moving from a room where you're having a tea and coffee and moving it to a pub where you could have a drink instead. And I'm not advocating, obviously, pissed or anything like that, but what I'm trying to say is that that helped us bring in more men because they didn't feel
like they were
under scrutiny and stuff like that constantly. And they didn't feel like it was a support meeting. They felt like it was more of a social.
Just come for a chat, come for a drink.
Which is so important, because I think that's exactly how we felt when we started the Worst Girl Gang Ever, is that all the support that we could find and was so information led and so sort of, we used to call it lilac and feathers, you know, it was very much like, whereas we just wanted to be angry, and we wanted to give people the space to be angry and to swear. Be like, this is fucking shit. And laugh because you don't cease to have a humour, or you don't cease to, you know, be a dickhead sometimes.
And that's what I meant when I said about the groups. It was whilst obviously it suits some people, it doesn't suit everybody. Mm. And that's why we did start our own group in that respect and the nervous laugh.
I
just wanted to stand up and just shout, you know, what fucking...
This is
just horrendous. We're all sitting here and we're all solemn. And yes, we're upset. And yes, you know, we've been through a tragedy, but we don't have to live 24/7 in that moment, if that makes sense. Mm, and it almost felt like you had to do it. You had to turn the switch on when you walked in there, and then you turn the switch off when you walked out. And it doesn't work like that.
And we got removed to the back room.
The back room.
Yeah.
It's like being sent to your bedroom as a kid.
Too jolly.
We put people off, and I'm like, no.
Did you get anyone sent?
What did you put people off?
If we were too happy, and everyone who had ever met us said no. Every time we met you, we just thought, bloody hell, at least we know there's hope. At least we know
we will be
able to laugh again. We will be able to at this point. Yes, okay, it's horrendous when you first go, but seeing us and seeing that actually you'd kind of rebuilt your lives or were rebuilding them, and yes, it was shit, but at the same time, you could still have a laugh and kind of swing between, just gave people hope rather than, lilac and feathers.
It's so important for people to remember as well. If you're listening to this and you're having a little giggle, I hope you're having a little giggle, but it's so important to remember that that doesn't mean that you've forgotten about your baby, and it doesn't mean that the heartbreak is any less or that you're getting over it or anything like that. You know, I think we hold this fear that when we start to laugh and smile again, it means that we're moving on, but you don't. You move forward, right? Because you have to move forward because that's life, but you don't move on. And it doesn't mean that you're forgetting or getting over or doing your baby any kind of injustice.
It's a balance. It's got to be a balance of grieving, but at the same time, being able to have that distraction and just time for your brain to switch off.
Yeah.
That grief side is so draining and so exhausting. You need this as a bit of an uplift.
Also, as well, I mean, like, you know, Lily would be 12. She would have been 12 in February. So I think about my eldest son when he was 12. What would he want? He would want his mum and dad to be happy, you know, gets a bollocking every now and then for when he's naughty. But
every now and then.
Yeah. But he would want, they would want us to be happy. They wouldn't want you to just be permanently depressed and living your life without moving forward. And you're right, it's not moving on, it's moving forward.
Yeah.
I don't think embracing is the right word, but it becomes part of your life.
Yeah.
And
it's rebuilding,
it shapes your future, doesn't it?
You have to rebuild your life with them included and with your experience. And you're on this journey now for life, unfortunately, but it can be done. It can kind of all be interweaved.
Yeah. Mm. So other than the, obviously, setting up the charity, was it a charity straight away?
No.
We raised money for Sands, actually.
Oh, got you.
Foundation in her name, but we gave the money to Sands. And then after a couple of years, there was money that we wanted to put into various hospitals within the Midlands. And because it had gone through international Sands, the sort of red tape and hurdles that you
had
to jump over to get money directed was very difficult. So, and that was just because of the way, you know, they ran things. I'm not saying it was right or wrong, but we just then decided that we could be transparent about the money that we were raising, because that's what we found, that when people are giving you money, they want to know where the money's going to.
Yeah.
Mm. And we were kept saying, oh, you know, it's gone to Sands, but then we had no tangible sort of thing to show for.
Yeah, what's it being used for? Research, support?
That's when we then decided to go for charity status ourselves, and then be able to be transparent and direct the money into the hospitals and the support services locally that we wanted it to go to.
Yeah, that's great. So you obviously, that kept you busy and kept your mind's focused on something else. But what happened after you lost Lily with, like, family making? What did you leave it some time before you tried again?
No.
We did what they,
I was desperate. I literally, if you could have said to me when I walked out of hospital, right, you can try again, I would have definitely. So we did try, we left it a couple of months and we tried again. And I had an early miscarriage then. So I did get pregnant 3 months later and had an early miscarriage straight away. And then we kind of said, right, this is, because I'd got really obsessed with, literally that's all I wanted to do, try.
I think lots of people listening to this would definitely be able to relate to that.
We kind of said right, let's have a switch off. We went on holiday
and let's just see what happens.
It wasn't the drunkest I'd ever got in my life. The knee injury.
Yeah, she was playing knocked or running Portugal.
Yeah,
that's
it wasn't
why.
A good one.
No wonder you were banned from all the bloody support groups.
And then we kind of had a bit of a switch off and then got pregnant again. So it's about 6 months after losing Lily, I got pregnant again with Freddie, who is 10.
10, nearly 11,
And how was that pregnancy?
Horrific. I was literally locking in a corner at every given moment.
Were you looked after a little, like monitored a bit more closely?
Yeah, so we were really lucky. Our bereavement midwife that we had with Lily, they are very good at supporting you through next pregnancy as well. So as soon as we were pregnant, we kind of like went under their wing again, and they arranged kind of everything from early scans through to growth scans through to basically at the end of it, they were like, if you want to rock up here 24/7, you can. So I was there like a crazed lunatic every morning. Hi, me. Just monitor me, please. But like I say to all my ladies that come in, it's whatever gets you through that pregnancy, you've got to just go with it, no matter what. Even if you think, oh God, I'm going crazy, or anyone's going to think I'm crazy, if it gets you through that pregnancy, then...
It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks, does it? Absolutely doesn't matter.
So
I think that's where, as a society, we have people that worry too much about what others think of us.
Yeah, definitely.
When it comes down to things like baby loss, I think right at the start, I went through a phase of worrying what people were thinking of our situation or us as individuals. You know, I lost quite a few friends through it because I just couldn't. I had no time for idiots that just wouldn't be, you know, even just remembering a birthday or something like that was where it almost came across as though it was too hard for them to sort of accept. And I think that, you know, if there was a message to give is to not overthink that people are, you know, what people are thinking about you and what people are thinking about the situation you're in, because ultimately nobody understands that situation unless you're in it yourself. And you can worry all you like, but actually what's it going to do? It's not going to do anything. It's just going to make you 10 times worse.
Yeah. No. I think people, when you're in, you're the only one that's in your life 24/7 and other people dip in and out. But if you're starting to do things for the people that dip in and out, it doesn't make sense, does it? You need to be doing everything for the one that's been there, that's there all the time. Yeah. And that's you. So
also, when you say don't worry about what people are thinking of you, I think that extends to getting checked at the like maternity assessment unit and things like that as well. Personally, I went there a lot and I never once had the slightest little bit of what the hell are you doing here. There was no huffing, there was no sighing. Every single time it was met with, you know, professionalism and empathy. It was fantastic. So just don't want anyone to be discouraged from getting that medical help if they feel like they need it, even if they think it's unreasonable and it's just anxiety or whatever.
But anxiety is reasonable. This is, you know, we think it doesn't matter if you, you know, this whole perception that we have that your mental health, if you're an anxious person, that doesn't matter. It is just as important as putting your mental health at ease, putting your anxieties at ease is just as important as it is to find out that your baby's still doing okay. They're the same thing. They are the same level of importance. It's I think mental health is disregarded when it absolutely shouldn't be.
Yeah. I always say to a lot of my ladies as well that this isn't an irrational fear or irrational anxiety that you've suddenly decided, oh, I'm going to be worried this time. This has come off the back of all of our experiences, and it's so understandable. So yeah, go in if you need to, and actually they're there. It's that people go, oh, I don't want to bother them, or I don't want to, they could be seeing someone else. I'm like, but they're there working anyway. They haven't just got out of bed just to see you. They're there. You need to just use them. And like you said, just not care whether you're going in every day or twice a day. If you need to go in and it's helping you, then yeah, just crack on.
Plus, you're paying off national insurance anyway. So it's like, you know, that's what it's there for, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, your pregnancy with Freddie, you said.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you'd not only had a stillbirth, but you'd also had an early miscarriage. So you must have just been, there was no sort of sense of relief at all in that whole pregnancy.
No.
Right from the start.
I think you do trick yourself that you kind of think, oh, I'll be able to manage that bit, or that bit's going to be like an early bit. Once I'm over that, then I'll be okay till the end or whatever. And you quickly realise that actually there's no easy bit in it. I quite often get girls who kind of, if they've lost at 20 weeks or something, go, if I could just get past that bit, then I'll be okay. And then they get to that and then they go, oh, it hasn't just erased everything. It was a long pregnancy. It felt about 27 years, to be honest.
What were your main ways to cope with it? What would you advise others going through pregnancy after loss?
Rock in the corner. No, I was very good. Well, no, I wasn't. He was very good at telling me. I'd be like, oh, I'd quite often sit on things and be like, oh, I haven't felt many movements today, but I'll just wait a bit. And then he'd be like, what? Why are we waiting? Like, we'll just go in now. And I wish in subsequent pregnancies we did get better at just going in if there was an issue. But I wish that we had just literally kind of, I'd had that mindset of, right, if I'm worried, I'm going in, or if I don't feel right, I'm going in, or I'm going to ask for this, I'm going to push for that.
Yeah.
So I would just say to everyone that, yeah, you've got to do exactly what makes you feel right and not worry about what friends think, what family members think, what medical people think. Just do what you feel makes you comfortable.
One thing that I used to do was, I think Amy's sort of weekend was always, I don't mean like Saturday, Sunday, the end of the, you know, week of pregnancy fell sort of midweek. I think it was like a Wednesday or something.
Okay.
So the way I looked at it was that you get to Wednesday and then you had a couple of days to the weekend. And because you were naturally busy over the weekend, it seemed like the time was going a little bit quicker. Mm-hmm. So then you'd only have a couple of days until your next week, if you like. And I used to look at all these websites where you could look at, you know,
what size it is.
Yeah, and things like that. So I was aware of what was going on at the same time. But then, also, you know, not literally, but kicking Amy up the arse if there were things where she would say something where there hadn't been many movements or there was something, it would be a case of, no, come on, we're going sort of thing.
I'm glad that you clarified that wasn't literally.
You have to be careful nowadays, don't you?
We did, and I think that was the good thing in terms of hospital putting in appointments. We literally worked to our next appointment. So I couldn't even, like, people would say, oh, when's your due date? And I'd be like, oh, I can't even think about that. I couldn't tell you that because that just felt so out of reach.
Yeah.
I could only work kind of appointment to appointment. So I'd be like, oh, I don't know, but I've got a scan in 2 weeks' time and I'll get to that bit.
Yeah.
And then we'll reevaluate and then we'll think about the next appointment. And
setting so little goals. Little chunks. Yeah, little chunks.
It's like little working down to the day, even if, you know, if you're those first few weeks of pregnancy after loss are so long. But if you're working down to the day and you're doing what Laura always recommends and controlling the controllables, every time you put your head down on that pillow, it's an achievement, isn't it? You've got through that day. You've been able to do what you can to support yourself in pregnancy. You've taken your vitamins. You've eaten healthily. Yeah. You're getting a decent night's sleep. You've drunk enough water. That is an achievement. And I think it's really important what you say is, if you're listening to this and you are struggling with the anxiety of pregnancy after loss, just break it down. Don't think about 3 weeks' time. Don't think about next week. Just think about the day. Think about getting your head down tonight, starting again tomorrow, and then working it down into the day for the next few days.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about how you coped as a couple. Were there times when you were on different pages with grief or hope? Or were you always aligned?
We're never aligned. Never aligned. We're never aligned.
I saw you both. You started both to smile at the same point. Then, yeah.
Shall I let Amy tell you her version and then the real one? Yeah.
So, we were on, especially like right from the beginning. We came out of hospital, he dropped me at my mum's and he went straight up to our village to start fundraising. So he wanted to collect prizes. He was doing a golf day. He was on the, I'm just going to completely distract myself and I'm going to do a golf day and I'm going to fundraise and I'm not going to think about it. So I was like an emotional, just sobbing wreck. And he was, so straight away, literally, like you say, it was, we were worlds apart. You went back to work quite quickly. I didn't. And I really struggled in terms of, I thought he was doing much better. I couldn't cope with the fact that, why am I here like sobbing on the floor every day and you're going to work, you're doing this, you're doing that. And I think that caused even more issues almost because we were on a different page. And I just thought, no, I didn't. I knew it. I knew he cared. But when you're in that position and the person that you think is going through it exactly the same, isn't responding in the same way as you, again, it's that kind of like, well, why aren't I like that? Why can't I do that?
No, I wouldn't disagree with that. I would that was right, obviously, right from the start. And I think it was just over 6 weeks off work, and I was teaching at the time, and I was actually in my NQT year as well, which was
6 weeks off.
It is, because we did the garden. I had 6 weeks off work. I did. And then I went back to work. I think it was about 10 days before the Easter holiday. So I knew that I'd got another 2 weeks coming up and what have you. But then it sort of, I think it really hit me about a year later after her first birthday. It really, really hit me hard. I had a panic attack one evening and just, it was the lack of control sort of thing. I'd always had a slight phobia of sickness and vomiting. And there was one evening where I started to feel quite ill. And because of my underlying, which I wasn't aware of at the time, sort of understanding of my lack of control over situations, it made me a lot worse than I actually was. Ended up with panic attacks, ended up on medication and all that sort of stuff. And I think that was, I don't know what Amy would say. I think Amy probably reacted horrendously to start with towards me, but then very quickly realized, actually, this is delayed. It's not something that I could stop, shall we say. It was something that was very delayed. And then I had some more time off work. But I also think being in the type of school that I was in, which was a really quite difficult school in the middle of three very, very tough council estates in South Birmingham, was that a lot of the kids didn't give a shit, not about my situation, but just in general.
Yeah.
And my sort of response to that was that they didn't understand that they had a chance. They had an opportunity to do something in life. And all they were doing was pissing around in a lesson or getting themselves into trouble outside of school and stuff. And my love for teaching very, very quickly went because I just had no time for anyone that just didn't give a toss, basically.
And were you, so when this happened, were you, Amy, were you pregnant with Freddie?
Yes.
Yeah, you were, yeah.
So that must have put another strain on you know, having a kind of that, you know, I can't think of the right word, but like difficulty in your relationship whilst being having the anxiety and the grief that you're still managing. Yeah. So how did you get back on track as a couple? I take it you are back on track.
As we've said, we've never been on track. I think it took a long time, and we spent many years kind of almost doing a bit of a cycle of, we put a little bit of help in, we think it was okay, it would kind of go swimmingly for a little bit, and then maybe birthday would crop up or winter or something like that, and we'd all kind of fall apart again. And this probably went on for quite a period of time until Knobhead here realised that actually needed some proper help. And I think when you finally admitted that, and actually he finally went for some person-centred counsellor, was it? What did she do?
Should we just call it by its proper name? I just saw basically a psychiatrist and did some psychotherapy work around sort of anxieties and being able to manage it all. Very similar to sort of like CBT, but not CBT, if that makes sense.
There's a lot of different things mixed in, wasn't
yeah.
it? So like triggers and things like that, how to handle.
Yeah, things like that and how to deal with things like that. And a lot of it was around myself as well and looking at myself just like in the mirror or not liking myself or not liking what I'd become or, you know, I put a lot of blame on myself. There was a lot of sort of not being able to control what had happened and then almost going the polar opposite, trying to be too much in control of things.
Yeah, I think that's a common theme for men with this kind of grief is that they feel sort of such responsibility to have everything under control. And it's just men normally fix things and they sort of not control but they manage stuff, don't they? And when this is something that's completely out of your control, sort of a bit lost.
Yeah. And they can't fix it and they can't use all their normal.
And then you feel shit about yourself because you can't do it.
Yeah.
And did you, Ryan, at this point, did you know that your sort of these feelings that you were having were about, did you know that it was your unresolved grief with Lily?
Didn't know it was like unresolved grief because I don't think it was solely the grief.
Right.
I think there was a lot of stuff really that had just, I don't know, built up over the years or things that had maybe never been dealt with when I was a kid or, you know, things like that. I mean, I'm not talking, you know, like serious stuff as in, you know, like abuse and that sort of stuff, because it was never that sort of deep, but it was just things that...
Doesn't have to be, does it?
No.
It doesn't have to be the worst things that change your life and make you feel and think in a way that makes life difficult.
Yeah, my parents got divorced when I was 14 and I don't think that was ever dealt with at the time. And I think it was the way it was explained by the lady that I saw was almost like that rolling snowball down a hill and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was like everything.
More layers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, like you say, how do you manage? You just keep going when you've got a young family as well. It's 24/7 practical, physical stuff, isn't it? So you almost just keep going, going, going.
You don't have time to assess. We talk about this a lot with miscarriage, like, when you're physically going through that trauma and you're bleeding and you're in pain and stuff, you don't even have the capacity or the time or the, you know, the room to start thinking emotionally until all that physical stuff is out of the way. And I completely appreciate what you're saying. Like, you had a young family, you're dealing with the grief, you've never stopped just going. And sometimes I think we're all in danger of just going and going and going and going and going. And then you suddenly stop and you don't actually know who you are or what you're doing anymore. And that's actually a really frightening thing, I think.
Yeah. I get a lot of families. One of the other things that we've since done is we do one-to-one support now as well, because I retrained. And one of the things I quite often say to families is that I get a lot of them that come back when if they've had a subsequent pregnancy, generally when baby's about 6 months old, and they come back and they're like, they can't understand why they feel so bad or this has cropped up and stuff. And it's kind of like that, well, actually we've put grief on pause, or we've had to put grief on hold because of the pregnancy again and how stressful that was, and then dealing with a newborn. And so it's so common that all these things come back again.
I think when we spoke to Elle Wright from Feather in the Empty Nest, she said that something really interesting, that her grief, so she lost her little boy Teddy, and then when she had Olivia, every milestone that she reached with Olivia should have been like so amazing, but actually it was, there was this like cloud of grief over it because it was she was reminding her on the stuff that she'd missed out on with Teddy. And I think when, like, you know, 4, 6, 8 months old, they're really, babies are really starting to do lots of things, and I think that just brings it, you know, smack bang to the forefront that you should have done this before, and you should have been able to experience these things last time.
I think people forget, don't they? They forget really quickly what you've been through anyway, but then when you go through another pregnancy again, it's that kind of like, oh, brilliant, we can kind of follow up. We haven't got to go there.
You're and better now.
Bums, again, it's like you're saying, they go, oh, everything's fixed, but actually they don't realise that a new baby just brings a shitload of new emotions and
different
memories, milestones that you've got to deal with that haven't even kind of popped up before.
Yeah, definitely.
So always think how lucky people are to have never had to experience any of this.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, amazing. Lucky them. Anyway.
Yeah, I had pregnancies before loss, and that they seem like a different life. It was just you know, that the I feel stupid now for having ever been so naive. I know I count myself so incredibly lucky that I did have that. And in fact, my third baby, I had quite a lot of bleeding in the first few weeks of pregnancy. I'm just absolutely terrified of bad news. And then, you know, she was born, and then in the pregnancy where I lost the baby, I didn't have any bleeding, or, you know, it was a complete miscarriage, but no pain or bleeding whatsoever. And just even that, like, it just doesn't make sense in your head, and you can't overthink it, because it never will make sense when you have all these kind of feelings that don't work alongside each other. They're all valid and they're all there, and you just need to kind of find some way to manage them.
I think that's the biggest thing, is we try and make sense of everything, because that's how we're brought up, isn't it? You do this happens, and baby loss, nothing makes sense.
Doesn't make sense. No.
I just reposted something on our stories earlier that says, it's okay to feel like your loss is the worst loss in the world. It is the worst loss in your world.
Yeah.
So true, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, that comes back to people comparing. They go, oh, well, I don't want to say that because they've had worse. And at the end of the day,
exactly.
It just doesn't matter. This is horrific for you. It doesn't matter about anybody else. It's what you're dealing with, and you've got to go with what you're dealing with.
Mm.
So does the Lily May Foundation support people with all types of baby loss?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so we see people right through from, early loss all the way through to neonatal to medical terminations. We will support anybody, because sadly we know that they're all losses are valid, and it's about that individual and what they're going through and what support they need. So yes, we will see. Absolutely.
And how can people find you or find out more about you?
So we're on Facebook, so it's just the Lily May Foundation, and Instagram as well, which is Lily May 0702 10, which is her date of birth. We've also obviously got the podcast, which is at Still Parents Podcast. We're on Twitter as well. To be honest, if you just Google the Lily May Foundation, it comes up pretty much right at the top. There's lots of different ways of getting in contact.
Brilliant. Wonderful. And just going back to your podcast, so it's you and two other dads.
Yeah, so it's myself and Matt. So Matt is a bereaved dad who had support through the charity with his wife. He's now 6 years, coming up to 6 years, since they lost their daughter, Callie. And Dan is just a friend of ours who is a radio presenter. So he used to work for Capital and Galaxy Radio and the local radio stations. And the reason we asked him really was because of the sort of professional aspects of things and being able to produce it all and host
keeping,
it and
keeping you on topic,
keeping us on topic.
Are you saying ours isn't professional?
Not at all.
No, but you stay on topic though.
Because
I don't know.
Because we had the opportunity as well to use a studio, it was about using the equipment as well and knowing how to use all the equipment and stuff. So
it's just about a bunch of knobs, right?
Basically, yeah.
It's a night away from the missuses. Missuses?
The missuses?
Yeah. Although I ended up in hospital last week from that podcast studio. So
why?
So I don't know what you could actually see from the camera, but there's obviously the cameras that we have on us are on like a concertina spring. So they come from a like a rack above our heads. And as I was moving one of the cameras, the spring snapped and trapped my two fingers in the spring.
Oh my God, that sounds horrendous.
And
you still got your fingers?
Well,
Amy's like shaking her head. Like,
luckily, my
did you Freddie, belong actually, in
A&E? Luckily, the, Freddie was with me.
I got
Freddie
the phone call, and I was basically like, "If you don't need surgery, you better you're wasting my time. There's going to be a problem."
But yeah, I ended up with 3 stitches in my finger.
Man, it just shows that all you need really is a headset and a laptop.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
No injuries caring here.
Not going to get any injuries with that, are you?
He's swearing at us now, listeners. He's swearing.
Oh, guys, it's been lovely chatting to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming.
And, no problem. Thanks for
and good luck with everything. And, you know, if we can do anything to support you, that would be fab. Just let us know. And, keep up all of everything that you're doing.
You guys excellent. Too. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
No problem.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
And you.
Take care, guys.
Bye.
Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. And please, please, when you have a second, rate us, review us and share us. And let's get this taboo smashed. See you next week.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams. And to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process. So I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.